from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We take a look now at a little-known riot that happened in San Francisco's Tenderloin in the 60s that's considered the first known time a large group of transgender people fought back against police harassment. The riot at the restaurant known then as Compton's Cafeteria prompted big changes in the way the police would treat transgender people, and it's been captured in a new documentary called Screaming Queens, The Riot at Compton's Cafeteria. Joining me to talk about what happened that night is the documentary's co-director, Victor Silverman. He is a filmmaker and history professor at Pomona College, and as I said, the director of Screaming Queens, The Riot at Compton's Cafeteria. Welcome to Forum.
Oh, happy to be here, Mina.
So this year, and very soon, we will have the 50th anniversary of the riot.
That's correct. As far as we know, correction on what you said. The film is not new. It's 10 years old.
Oh.
So we've revived it. It'll be on KQED tomorrow at 6 on Truly California, but it was in the first season of Truly California back in 2005. So we've brought it back for the 50th anniversary of the riot.
And what is the date of the riot?
Well, that's a good question. We don't really know. And we know it was in the summer of 1966 or maybe in September. There's no good documentation. The police records from those years are lost or been destroyed or mysteriously vanished. And the Tenderloin in those years and queer people in general and trans people in particular were seen as so outrageous and strange that they shouldn't be paid attention to. The Tenderloin was a place that people didn't want to talk about. There wasn't news coverage. We didn't have cell phone cameras and things like that. And so events like the Compton's Cafeteria riot could occur, have a huge impact, and yet not appear in the mainstream media.
Compton's Cafeteria is no longer in the Tenderloin, but I'd like to help our listeners understand its significance to the transgender community and play a little bit from the documentary. This is a description of Compton's cafeteria that I believe is being presented by Amanda St. James.
You can go to Compton's and it was its own little fairyland. I remember the waitresses with the little doily napkins on their chest. It was beautiful because it was clean.
In the back of my mind, I remember when hell was raised, Compton's is certainly one of the sources.
Everybody would die for window seats just to show off.
Jehovah's Witnesses used to drag crosses down the street in front of Compton's and tell us we were going to burn in hell, but we ignored them. Compton's was fabulous. It was like Oz, something like the Wizard of Oz.
And actually, who we heard there was both Amanda St. James and Tamara Ching, who are both in your film. And the way that they describe the sort of refuge really gives you a sense that life in the Tenderloin was hard. What was it like back then for people who were transgender?
It was quite difficult. It's still quite difficult for trans people, especially trans people of color who have been disowned by their families and been kicked out. They can't get jobs, particularly in that era. There's open discrimination, of course. You could be arrested for walking the streets in clothes of the wrong gender. The police would see you as someone causing trouble, someone dangerous, involved in crime, and there's a lot of violence. It was a tough life, and a lot of them turned to prostitution, to drugs, to a lot of difficult things to make their way. And yet a place like Compton's provided a kind of community. And a Compton's Cafeteria and, in fact, gay bars in those years were refuges for queer people, for trans people, for gays, lesbians, for other people who didn't fit in the society. It was a place where you could come together and find friendship. There was a lot of competition. There was nastiness and conflict within them. But for the most part, it was a place where you could gain support. And those kinds of community institutions were marginalized, but they provided a really necessary part for people to survive. That was the importance of Compton's. It was open after the bars would close, so people would go to the bars. They would hang out, or if they were prostitutes, they would, you know, get Johns, and they would come back to the cafe to say, hey, we're alive.
You touched on this earlier, but could you say more about the relationship with the police? This is a big part of the documentary and how they you know, they had this very unpredictable way of dealing with the community. They would crack down whenever they wanted to, and other times they would, you know, get paid off, it sounded like, to leave folks alone.
Exactly. It was a very troubled relationship. And, you know, much like we're seeing today with the Black Lives Matter movement and the whole focus on police violence, the police had a very problematic relationship with the trans community and with queers in general in San Francisco and in cities throughout the country. The police, cleaning up vice districts, cleaning up perversion was something that politicians could promote and police officials could promote as a way of saying, look, we're cleaning up our city. But at the same time, the police regulated vice and controlled it so that it would occur in only in particular neighborhoods. That way they would protect the other neighborhoods of the city from these kinds of behavior. The other thing that's going on in the 1960s, which is really, I think, important for people to understand about San Francisco, is that the political and cultural dynamics of the city are undergoing dramatic change. You have a city which is presided over by a largely Protestant white elite, but the ethnic politics of the city is largely white. Right? Nowadays, we have a much more, you know, we've got Chinese, we've got, you know, Latino, there's black political factions. Those are just coming into being in the 1960s. And the police are part of, and the situation in the Tenderloin is caught up in the political ferment of those years. And the police are trying to keep control over the disruption that's happening in San Francisco. There's riots in Bayview's Hunter's Point in 1965. You've got the beginnings of the counterculture movement coming along. To many people in San Francisco, it seemed like society was falling apart and they needed to clamp down. And clamping down on queer people causing disruption in the Tenderloin was one way to do it.
We have a clip here of Amanda St. James describing what it was like when the police would clamp down, what the conditions were like in jail.
You were isolated on a tier with other transsexuals. You had no contact with any of the other prisoners on the outside. We were in lockdown most of the time. And it wasn't that I had done anything wrong. It was female impersonation. I wasn't bothering anybody. But I was dressing as a woman the way I feel, so they put me in jail, shaved my head, or I refused to let them shave my head, and they put me in the hole, in lockup. One girl was in there 60 days in the hole because she wouldn't let them cut their hair. That's how important it was to us back then. They were, you know, it was like they were trying to humiliate us, that we weren't human beings, so they should humiliate us.
That's a clip from the documentary Screaming Queens, The Riot at Compton's Cafeteria. It's talking about the first, what is considered the first known act of collective resistance to police harassment by the transgender community in 1966. And I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. Curious what your reactions are to this story. If you are familiar with what happened at Compton's in 1966, even before this documentary came out, I guess, a decade ago, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum at kqed.org, post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Facebook or Twitter. One of the things, Victor Silverman, that I found interesting about this was the role of the Vietnam War in terms of both empowering the community and also at the same time, you know, having this crackdown at the same time by police, you know, with all the torment and fervor that was going on around it. And what was empowering about Vietnam, the Vietnam War?
Well, what was empowering for
the transgender community?
And for the women who describe themselves as the queens in the film, that hence the Screaming Queens, was that it brought a lot of young men through San Francisco who were interested in having a good time before they went off to perhaps die in Vietnam. The nightlife of San Francisco and the kind of wild nightlife of San Francisco, much of it occurred in the Tenderloin. So it was a place to go after hours and have a great time. And here were all these new people coming through who were displaced from their families, who were out looking for adventure or excitement, many of whom themselves were queer in some way. And they connected with people in the Tenderloin. So it was provided a lot of excitement and change. There are other aspects to it as well. The Vietnam War disrupted gender roles in American society in a real way. To resist the war as a man meant that you weren't being properly manly. And so you would wear long hair or wear flowing clothes. And there was a kind of gender politics of how you presented yourself, which fit with what the queens in the Tenderloin were already doing.
Yeah, and it was interesting that that's part of what led to some of the issues emerging, sort of the kindling for the fire that would later emerge, because you have people feeling more empowered, right? At the same time that you have, authorities trying harder to crack down on vice as well. And one of the other things that helped breed was the rise of a group called Vanguard. Can you help knit together for us the Vietnam War, the poverty programs that were emerging from the federal government, and then the rise of this group called Vanguard?
Well, one of the things about the Tenderloin, which I already mentioned, is that it was a marginalized community in San Francisco. As the mobilization of ethnic politics in San Francisco started to shift in the 1960s, the Tenderloin was left out of that because there wasn't a clear ethnic political leadership like there was, say, in Bayview Hunters Point with someone like Willie Brown, right? You don't have that kind of leadership in the Tenderloin. So there was a political problem for people in the Tenderloin about how do you get access to resources to help the community. And people around Glide Church, Cecil Williams, who had taken over as the minister there, helped sponsor a kind of new forms of organizing and activism in the community. So the church community was key to this, bringing in new forms of activism and connection. And one of the things that Glide did was host groups of young people to provide them social connections, to provide support. And one of the groups that they supported was a group called Vanguard, which was one of the first counterculture queer organizations that we know of in the world. It was a very dynamic group of young people who weren't like the street queens, the transgender people who work the streets in San Francisco in a kind of older political economy. They were a new group, and they had a new ideology, and they weren't going to put up with the harassment and corruption that had gone on before. They start to hang out and meet at Compton's cafeteria at the same time. So you've got all these different things in play. There's also a lot of pressure, just as there is today, on the Tenderloin because of redevelopment. You've got destruction of housing elsewhere in the city, the Tenderloin becoming the last place for affordable housing in the central city area, along with a little bit of the south of Market at this point. So there's a lot of pressure on the neighborhood. And you've got these new political configurations, both at the higher levels and at this grassroots level of a group like Vanguard, which is kind of hippie-like, but also very political.
So at that night in Compton's cafe, when it sounded like the management wasn't too keen on this Vanguard group being there, and asked the police to come in. And essentially, it was just this moment when they decided enough was enough and they were going to fight back against police. Just paint us a picture of what happened at Compton's that night.
Well, from what we know, it was both Vanguard kids and this other group of transgender street queens, as they called themselves, who were both there at the same time. And as far as we know, it was actually one of the transgender people who started it rather than someone from Vanguard. But the description is that there was the management called the cops. The cops walk in. Someone gets pissed off at the police and throws their coffee at them. And then the whole place erupted and started to fight back against the police and the rioting. They broke out the windows. They burned a police car. They attacked a police car. They burned a newspaper stand. A newspaper stand is, for your listeners, is something where they sold these old things called newspapers. And they poured out in the streets and fought about 100 or so people. One thing, you know, your listeners might be interested in is there are a number of other events in addition to the screening that we can talk about that are coming up to commemorate this 50th anniversary of the riot.
Well, before we do that, let me invite our callers back into the conversation again, 866-733-6786. And you're listening to Victor Silverman. He is the director of Screaming Queens, the riot at Compton's cafeteria, which again is considered the first known act of collective resistance to police harassment by the transgender community. And I'd like to go now to Felicia Elizondo. She was in the documentary Screaming Queens. How are you, Felicia? Are you with us?
Huh?
Hi, Felicia. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thanks so much for being with us this morning. You know, one of the things that struck me, I was talking with Victor Silverman earlier just about, you know, how hard life was in the Tenderloin. And you talk about the limited options that you had and how it led you to prostitution while you were living in the Tenderloin.
I think it was 1963, I lived in San Jose, California. I was one of these little gay boys, queer sissies, jotos, whatever they wanted to call me in those days. And in 1963, when I was around 15 or 16, I had a sugar daddy that came, brought me to San Francisco, and that's where I found out what the Tenderloin was all about. And then me and my friend, Bernie, started playing hooky from school and coming on the Greyhound bus depot on 7th and Market and coming into the Tenderloin and finding out what, you know, what it was all about. But we only stayed in front of Katie's most of the time because we were afraid to actually go into the middle of the Tenderloin because we were scared. But then we met this guy by the name of Cero, and he took us to his apartment, and he told us and we were sitting there, and all of a sudden, he's putting on a makeup, redding his hair, putting on makeup, and wearing Angora sweaters and skin-tight pants, and he called himself a hair fairy. That's as close as to being a woman as he could be. So the only way that they could do that is by, they wouldn't hire sissies, jotos, or queers in that looked different. So our best bet was to go to prostitution or to sell drugs.
Well, I was really moved by how dangerous that was to be involved in prostitution at the time. And I have a clip of you in the film that I'd like to play that describes some of the things that you were facing.
Okay.
And here we go.
Most of it was because of harassment. We just got tired of it. We got tired of being harassed. We got tired of being made go into the men's room when we were dressed like women. We wanted our rights.
Sorry, that was actually Elise, Amanda St. James talking about the harassment by the police. But you talked about how, you know, sometimes people wouldn't take kindly to realizing that you were transgender once they, you know, had hooked up with you.
Well, the trouble is, at that time, transgender wasn't even used. It was just queens, sissies, jotos, and queers that hung around the Tenderloin that their parents had threw them out like trash and didn't want anything to do with them. Most of the people that came into the Tenderloin was not in the news or in the media. It was a word of mouth. And when they came into the Tenderloin, they came in with a new identity and a new respect for themselves, a new life for them, because the Tenderloin was a four-block radius, and it was just a place where we didn't go out of very, very, a lot of times out of that area.
Yeah.
The only time we would actually go out of that area is when we went to Playland, at Ocean Beach. Does anyone remember the carnival that used to be there a long time ago? That's when we used to play and be kids, because when we came into the Tenderloin, we had to survive and we had to sell ourselves and sell drugs, and that's the way our lives were.
How did life change for you after the riot?
Well, after I was there before, during, and after. The riot didn't change a lot because Compton's Cafeteria was still working, and I totally appreciate the Compton's Cafeteria because it gave us a place where we could hang around and know where we had made it that night. Nobody else would do it. We had no organizations. The Vanguard was nothing but white people, and, you know, Mexicans, Asians, and blacks would not, at that time, would not even join such an organization like that.
Yeah. Did the cops leave you alone more, though, after Compton's?
No, they was when they were decided that they needed their quota. They would come in and harass the girls. Mm. I was walking down the street, and they would take me up for obstructing a sidewalk. They would take me up for contributing to a delinquency of a minor and prostitution. But all those charges were dropped. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing was ever, no trick was going to come in and testify.
And Felicia Elizondo, what does it mean to you to have this film now document your lives and to celebrate, your resistance?
Well, you know something? I totally am honored that Susan Stryker and Victor Stillman did this film, because when all the thing was happening, we were young kids. We had no thing that it was going to be anything, you know. It was just, and it wasn't in the media and the television, so it wasn't nothing. It was just kids that wanted to stay and be where they want, who they were in that area. And after the riot, it's just that it continued for a while, but we learned about a couple of trans women that were transsexual, like, God, I forget her name. She was a stripper in North Beach. Roxanne was a stripper at Roxanne. But it didn't pertain to us because we were sissies. You know, I learned about my true self when I went to Chicago in 1969 and saw the Christine Jorgensen movie.
Mm, yeah.
I stood there and I said, oh my God, this is who I was meant to be.
Well, Felicia Elizondo, you are an original screaming queen, and it was an honor to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I want to remind people that they can watch the full documentary on our website, kqed.org/forum, and the film will air on Truly California this Saturday on KQED 9 at 6 p.m. I want to go to Sky in Athens, Texas. Hi, Sky.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I was just wondering, does he think things are going to get better?
You mean our director, Victor Silverman?
Yeah, for trans people, because as a trans man in Texas, I don't really feel safe with the police, personally.
Sky, thanks for sharing that.
Well, it's there's continuing problems for trans people throughout the country. You know, here in the Bay Area, it's not ideal either. You know, there's been there continues to be tremendous rates of violence, and as Felicia pointed out, particularly for trans people of color, they have one of the highest murder rates, if not the highest murder rate in the country. And it's very unsafe for people to end up in police custody. They're often subject to violence. There's a lot of problems. But one point, though, is that there's moments where these things get better, and then there's pushback where they get worse. So in the immediate aftermath of the riot, there was a police sergeant, Elliot Blackstone, who we were lucky enough to have in the film, who went through a process of learning and understanding about trans people that helped him become someone who supported and helped the community and acted in the way that we hope police will act, which is to protect and to help people rather than to contain and be violent against them. He was able to do that because there was a police chief in San Francisco at that time who supported him. He was sabotaged by other police in the department, and the
For this reason, he actually tried to reach out and
right. He was officially the liaison to the gay community in San Francisco and one of the first people in the San Francisco Police Department to do that. The other police didn't understand it. They didn't like it. They planted drugs in his office, and he had to retire early. So there was this moment where there was a great bit of progress, and then it was pushed back. We've seen this over and over again in police departments and in changes. In a way, the reason why we're seeing so much about police violence today is because the moment of reform that we saw in the 1960s got pushed back in the 1970s and 1980s. So those moments of change where we can get police departments that actually are there helping people, are part of the community, and are protecting people, those are things that can happen, but they can also be reversed.
Well, I want to thank Sky for the question. And Dina writes, I'm a docent at the Oakland Museum. We do LGBTQ tours in the History Gallery, and one of our topics is the Compton Cafeteria. We proudly emphasize how California was the location of this rebellion against the police before Stonewall. And you can check out the museum's website for tour dates in June and September. Victor Silverman, so, you know, when we go into the Tenderloin now, where can we see evidence of this, you know, of this event?
Well, there's a plaque.
I know Compton's no longer there.
Compton's is no longer there. It closed. And the chain is gone. But there's the Tenderloin Museum is a wonderful place people can go. There's going to be a series of events at the Tenderloin Museum at the GLBT History Museum, which is
in Castro.
And
you were mentioning there's also
Castro.
A plaque. I'm sorry.
Right. There is a plaque. I'm sorry. There's a plaque right at the corner of Turk and Taylor, which is the site of the Compton's Cafeteria. It's in that was installed a couple years after the film came out as part of one of the first commemorations. And I know Felicia Elizondo was one of the people involved in getting that to happen, along with Cecilia Chung and some other activists there in the LGBT Community Center.
And we just have 30 seconds left, but, you know, Sky's question about, will things get better? What do you think about the NBA pulling its 2017 All-Star game from North Carolina because of their transgender bathroom law? Is that a sign of progress to you?
Absolutely. The fact that these stories are out there that people recognize and see transgender people in ways that they were hidden before, that's a fantastic change. And it's something that occurred in part because of the people we portrayed in the film.
Well, Victor Silverman, director of Screaming Queens, The Riot at Compton's Cafeteria, thanks so much for letting us know about this important event. And we have a link to a list of local events marking the riot's anniversary on our website, kqed.org/forum, and it's available to watch on our website and tomorrow at KQED9. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.